Almighty and eternal Father, as thy children, as we enter into thy presence to worship you in spirit and truth, we give thanks unto all that has been wrought for us for the majesty of thy grace, for this great day in which all Christendom celebrates the mighty power of thy resurrection, bears testimony to the finishing of thy covenant with us, for the establishment of our liberty and freedom from the powers of sin. We thank thee, our Father, that at this hour we can stand before thee, thy children, justified by thy grace, looking into thy face, knowing that we stand without charge because you said it was finished, having accomplished the putting away of all transgression with the sacrifice consummated, the mighty power of thy resurrection established the power of an endless life for those that constitute thy household. Looking forward unto the achievements and victories which the dynamic of thy spirit will have wrought through thy people, in the establishment of the nations of thy kingdom in the midst of the earth with power, of the leadership of thy household to establish forever thy purposes. We pray, our Father, that in these events through which we pass as crises in our time, that we shall be stimulated with the realization of the mighty power of thy resurrection, of the indestructibility of thy kingdom. May we take out of the passages and out of the lessons which surround this period we celebrate the full story of the identity of our enemy, of his strategy, of the way he thinks and how he acts. May we understand the way of the serpent, that we might bind the darkness, that we might recognize that there is no dual standard, nor is there any way that we can integrate the program of the serpent into our nation, our race, or our faith. And so, our Father, as we lift up thy standards and look unto thee from whence comes our life, our hope, and our origin, we say thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In thy name we ask it. Amen. Tonight, as we talk to you about the time when they tried God in earth and open up facets of the trial of Jesus, it is probably one of the most important areas of observation that you can make concerning the animosity of those that were against Christ and the way they function, operate, and think. Leopards do not change their spots. Children follow in the course of their fathers. It's very important to know who your enemy is and who their father is. When we talk about the magnitude of God's ministry in the earth, there can be no question upon the mighty impact of the manifestation of God embodied in the flesh. There can be no question about the impact upon the land of Palestine, upon the peoples of Judah and Benjamin, of this great and mighty visitation. While we well understand that from the very beginning of the prophecies which have been bestowed to Israel about the manner in which Christ would come, it had been anticipated and looked forward till until the signs were fulfilled with the birth of Christ. The ancient customs of the people had long been maintained in expectation that ultimately Messiah would come and complete and put into operation the mighty interventions of God for the fullest established freedom, for a manifestation, an area of grace that they could not understand even at that time. But in the course of all processes of history, God was embodied in earth and walked among men. We should take a look tonight at Palestine, the land to whence Christ came. What was its nature and who were its people in the hour of the beginning of his ministry? For we are all been told that this was the land of the Jews, and truly Jews lived there, but this was not the land of the Jews. This was a land that had been given unto Abraham ages before and had been settled by Sethites in ages before that. And in the instance of this, the Sethites later, having migrated some of them down into the land of On, had built great cities and mighty altars unto God. Others had been attacked by Canaanites and evil powers out of the hills. It was into this land that God led Moses and the house of Israel. And here in this land of Palestine, he had made a covenant with Abraham and said that he would give this land unto him and to his seed after him forever. As it relates to the land of Palestine today, it still belongs to all the house of Israel. It belongs to all the people that are Christians in the world tonight. Well, you say, well, that's not who's down there now. No, we know who's down there now. The abomination of the desolators of the land of Palestine now, and I'll prove to you they haven't changed any since the days when Christ was upon the earth. I point out to you that in the instance of the land of Palestine being settled by Judah and Benjamin, this follows the return under Nehemiah to rebuild the temple. When Judah and Benjamin returned to the land of Palestine, they started on the construction of the temple and the rebuilding of the land. But there was a mixed multitude that came along that recognized also that there was great value in attaching themselves to these peoples of the Most High God. And so they started to filter in. They were Amalekites, Hittites, Canaanites, all the ancient enemies of the house of God. They had one thing in common. They had a common origin, and they had had among them high priesthoods of evil descendancy. The Canaanites, of course, were the descendants of Lucifer, as the book of 2 John declares they were the progeny of the wicked one. These Canaanites also were aligned with an ancient group of the enemies of the kingdom of the Most High God, for out of ancient Asia came the Sadducees, the reincarnationists of the cult of Kali, or ancient Lilith, the wife of Lucifer. And so we have Amalekites, Canaanites, and we have the Sadducee cults that were also an Asiatic type of Jew. When we say Jew, remember that the people that are the real constituted Jews are those that have descended from all the forces and houses and groups of the fallen angelic hosts. So many people use the word Jew to refer to all the peoples of the land of Palestine, but this was not so. In fact, there lived in the land of Palestine then Judah and Benjamin. And they had established again their temple, and they were following the pattern of the old laws. And the infiltration that continued to come in continued to enter into Israel and claim that they were being converted to the faith. Claimed also that they wanted to become participants in the areas of the land of Palestine's new rising government. But of course, the new converts were only seeking to identify themselves to a faith to gain control of the land. In fact, in the days of Jesus' time, why Rome had conquered the ancient province, that after the War of the Maccabees, the struggles that had taken place, we have a division between the lands. The division was between two kinds of theology. In the first place, all that were true Israel stock of Judah and Benjamin continued down with the ancient tradition, believing in the covenant of the promise of Messiah, believing in eventually the power of God to even raise the dead, and that all of the Adamic household and all of Israel would eventually be raised. Thus, these people were called Pharisees, and they believed in the resurrection. Their destiny of doctrine goes back in origin to the days when Job, one of the oldest of all authors inside the scripture, for he wrote long before Moses was born. That was one of those that with Enoch had been in Egypt in a period about 5004 B.C. Thus it is, inside of the book of Job, he was one who said, "I know that my Redeemer liveth and shall stand in latter days upon the earth. I know that though I die and the worms consume this body, yet with these eyes in this body will I behold my Redeemer," because he had faith in the resurrection. Those in your race out of this wisdom school of knowledge that continue to be a part of the priesthood, for in the days when the priesthood under Moses was set up and the Levites had the responsibility among all of Israel of producing the clergy throughout all periods of time, they were trained in the schools of spiritual wisdom as well as the wisdom of the fulcrum, or the application of the knowledge of law. So under this natural law, the Levites were all taught the process of the resurrection. Resurrection and the power of God to raise the dead was one of their great hopes and faiths, and they knew that a mighty day would come known as Resurrection Day. Now the Sadducees that dwelt in the land of Palestine were Asiatic, Canaanites, and Amalekites. They followed satanic doctrine. They were reincarnationists, and they had nothing in common with Israel. They did not descend from Israel's stock, but they had claimed that they accepted the laws of Moses. They accepted the identity of the God of Israel by their declaration, only to gain power. But these Sadducees were just a bunch of kike politicians, if we want to frame it up, because this is what they were. The show of their countenance was against them, the way they functioned and operated was against them, and they would give lip service to anything, just like great numbers of them join the church today, profess some area of Christianity in order to gain influence in the church and to make money and merchandise out of you. Well, they did it at that time. Only the great goal was to control the temple, to gain power. And thus it was that they designed to gain power and to control the Sanhedrin. It was, as we remember, prior to the birth of Christ, that the land of Palestine had waxed quite important in the Roman Empire, because money changers that had gold from the conquest of ancient Babylon's days that escaped before the rule of Medo Persia and the rise of the Greco Empire were located in the Isle of Pergamus. Now, if you go to the scriptures in the book of Revelation, you'll find that Pergamus was where Satan's seat was. And here all the gold money changers of world jewelry had their international deposits of finance, and with this they manipulated empires, because the empires didn't know that this is where the gold was. Out of this instance, they had to use great influence. They had paid and bought the appointment of Herod as king of the Jews, and Herod as king of the Jews was made the head of the province in the land of Palestine. Thus also, at the same time, a struggle had been going on. Herod, you remember, was king of the Jews at the time of the birth of Christ. remember, than a struggle for the Sanhedrin. Now, the Sanhedrin is composed of a ruling body under ancient Israel law. In fact, I have a copy here of the Mishnah, which is the oral law, which, of course, is codified and doesn't remain oral. And we have also the written law, which is the old law of Israel. And even today, the recognition of this law must also rest upon all who claim they're Israel, even when they're not, because the Mishnah is old. Now, added to this many times are the oral tradition of rabbis that have no part nor lot in this matter, but the antiquity of the Mishnah that exists before the time of Christ and reaches back into the courts of the days of the kings is the unquestioned true Mishnah, and they must abide by its decision. And thus it was that the Sadducees wanted to gain control of the Sanhedrin. There are three Sanhedrins, or two Sanhedrins in a lesser court. Out of the rule of the Mishnah, I can assure you that the greater Sanhedrin had 71 members upon it. This greater Sanhedrin was an ecclesiastical as well as a deciding court as it related to the offenses and to the affairs of men. It decided on the basis of ecclesiastical law, and it executed under the authority that reposed in it as the highest authority in Israel in the areas of judgment. Now, it alone could try a high priest or a false prophet or one charged as having borne false witness or a whole city or community that had turned to apostasy. Then there was the lesser Sanhedrin. This was a court made up of 23 men. These 23 men had the authority to try a capital offense as long as it wasn't a high priest and it wasn't a false prophet. Now, under this instance, this a capital offense they could try as it related to the Mosaic law or any pattern of moral or ethical justice, or even to the point where one had cried or performed acts of blasphemy. Then there was a lesser court, which was always comprised by a succession of some three judges that took care of all of the misdemeanors and local offenses and petty thefts and crimes of this nature. Now, it must be remembered, therefore, that the 71 men of the greater Sanhedrin, the 23 of the lesser Sanhedrin, which made a total of 94, become the supreme force of decision inside of the land. And there was also substitutes that could be selected to fulfill the areas of the court. Now, there are many rules that govern this court, and I think this is of great significance. Because under the Roman administration, because there was such contest between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, it was determined, therefore, that there had to be a representation upon the court that was somewhat equivalent to the dispersion in the land of peoples of the persuasion that were either Sadducees or Pharisees in their thinking. Thus it was that the Pharisees, which were the true house of Israel, the true priests out of the house of Israel that believed in the laws of God, they were actually the lawyers who believed in what the Bible taught and what God had authorized. And they, by their numbers, controlled and had the overwhelming number of seats in the Sanhedrin. The Sadducees, who were actually not Israelites at all, though some people were not aware of this because of their affluence and power, but had made up this other evil background, and they had, with their doctrines of evil and their rejection of the resurrection, had still unable ever to gain control of the temple. So back before the time of the birth of Christ, they very seemingly had tried a strategy which did work. This strategy was a strategy of having a man who lived not far outside of the city of Jerusalem himself, but a man who had great estates and whose agricultural fields, whose olive groves and whose vineyards had caused many people to be added to his hire. And so they belonged to the house of this man whose name was Shammah. Now this man was a Sadducee, and he was a part of what we would call today the Nazareth of our day, and they wanted to compute how are we going to get control of this great Sanhedrin. And so the design was this. Well, suppose you and those that work for you all become Pharisees. And if you become Pharisees and all that are under the influence of your lands become Pharisees and reject the doctrine of the Sadducees and astutely proclaim that you support the resurrection and the doctrines of the Pharisees, behold, they will adjust the number of the Sanhedrin, and more Pharisees will be put on the Sanhedrin. Now, whereas this will be arranged according to areas, it'll be possible for more Pharisees to be put upon the Sanhedrin that are actually Sadducees, but they cannot displace who are Sadducees from the seats that we already have. Thus, by this process, what will transpire will be in courts of law that are most vital, such as in matters of election. There will be more Sadducees capable of voting, even if they do not sit at this time upon the court, because it would be limited to the number which is already declared. And so the house of Shammah did this, and they were mighty converts to all the doctrines of the Pharisee concept. And my, what extreme wigglers they became. And so the number of voters who were adjusted for the election of the high priest among the Sadducees and the Pharisees who helped to make up the Sanhedrin. And so in this instance, the law governed by even Rome that they would have to have representatives accordingly who vote for the high priest and who thus would also vote for the selection of the Sanhedrin's prophet. So what transpired? When the election came around, why, they had accomplished the packing of the court until they had, not voting with the Pharisees at all, but false Pharisees, voting with the Sadducees enough to capture the court. Thus, by a cheap Jewish trick, they captured control of the court in the land of Palestine before the birth of Christ. Thus it was, the high priest that was elected was a Canaanite by the name of Annas. Now, Annas the Canaanite remained in power until the year 14. In the year 14, after the birth of Christ, why, this man was deposed by the procurator of Jerusalem, who came from Rome and deposed him, and would not accept, because of certain acts which he had committed, which were in the areas of graft and bribery, removed Annas from the authority by Rome and forced him to have another election. And so this was under the orders of Gaius, and the man that was elected was his son-in-law, showing the powerful hierarchy that these Canaanite Jews of their day had. And the man that they selected was Caiaphas, who was high priest at the time of the trial of Christ. However, Annas had remained a high priest during the time that Herod was the king and at the time of the birth of Christ. You will remember also at the time of the birth of Christ that Herod, the king of the Jews, and a consort and friend of the high priest had tried to murder the Messiah as soon as he was born. Isn't it a strange thing that a Jewish king with a Jewish army would try to put to death a Messiah if they were Israel? They well knew nothing about this matter, and as you well remember, even Herod, king of the Jews, did not know who the Messiah was to be or where he was to come from, knew nothing about the prophecies of the Scriptures, and when the wise men came, this king of the Jews had to send for scribes to tell him what the Scriptures said, proving again that he was not an Israelite and had no hope nor part in this matter. But now we have the mighty miracle of the embodiment of God, the birth of Christ, the growth of the and manifestation of his knowledge and his wisdom was known throughout the land of Palestine. All the last 2 weeks, Christendom has been meditating upon great events that surrounded the life of Christ, surrounded the design of the people to crown him king, the conspiracies that were raised against him, the hours of his great and mighty passion. And thus, as we consider the elements of this trial, I want you to know that from the day that Christ started the performance of his miracles and started his testimony of his purpose in his kingdom, he was on trial before a power of evil that was designing to destroy him. In no less than 17 places, the Jews have borne record, and the Scriptures tell us how they planned to put him to death, to take him by stealth, or to pull some evil conspiracy in play. They wanted to get the Pharisees themselves, of course, to charge him if they could. The false Pharisees, who belonged to the house of Shema, were to put into our English language the word shame to this day. The word shame comes from the false status of Shema, who said he was something he was not, in order that he might gain power over holy things. So he that with a testimony that is a lie seeks to gain power over holy things is Shema, or shame, and that's where the word comes from in the English language. The fact remains that during the ministry of Christ, these forces continually sought to oppose Jesus. And Jesus, because this was the embodiment of God, he not only knew all things, he knew each and every one of them and who they were and from whence they came. This is one reason why all through the ministry of Jesus that he points out constantly to the people that are Judah and Benjamin, the sheep of his pasture. He said, I've come for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He said, these Jews on Solomon's porch, he said, these Jews are not my sheep, as I said unto you. And of course, as we turn over here to the book of John, it was Jesus who said, when they sought to entrap him as he was speaking to the people and said, you shall know the truth shall make you free. And a certain Jew standing by, always this Jewish Ogbu from this Canaanitish group of the high priest was around. And they said, now, what do you mean you'll make us free? We've never been in bondage at any time. And thus with wisdom, supreme wisdom, Jesus had trapped them into saying that they were never in bondage. And thus made it very easy for him in the following words, which we find here recorded in the book of John, to show that these Jews were a fraud, were not Israel at all. And he said, oh, he said, you've never been in bondage? This is quite obvious that if you were Abraham's seed, you'd have been in bondage, because if you'd have been in Egypt in the days when Jacob's descendants were in Egypt, at the time of Joseph, you were not in bondage in that time, and up to the time of Moses, you were not Israelites. if we're not in bondage under the ten tribes that were carried away captivity under the days of Sennacherib, then you were not Israelites, because Israel was carried away bondage under Sennacherib. If ye were Judah and Benjamin, you'd have been in bondage under Babylon. So if you've never been in bondage at any time, you're a fraud. So they had trapped themselves. They said, why? How say thou this? We have one Father, even God. Jesus said, if God were your Father, ye would accept me. He says, I am of God. Ye are of your father, the devil. The lust of your father ye will do. He was a liar and a murderer in the beginning. You are Canaanites, he said. You cannot understand the truth because you cannot understand or hear my speech. There's no spiritual power in you. Now, Christians throughout the nation are being hoodwinked today by illiterate clergy. You say, what's an illiterate clergy? They're well-educated. Look at all the volumes and tomes they've studied and translated. My friends, the most illiterate clergyman is a man that doesn't know the Word of God. You better learn your Bible first. Now, it's important that they study to show themselves approved unto God, know its languages and its texts, know its transitions and know its changes. Know who it is that tampers with the Bible, but still they couldn't suppress the truth. Understand why the mighty indictments that Christ made have been declared and yet not enforced or understood clearly by the church. It's because, my friends, they have listened to a little text about the birds, the bees, and the beautiful flowers, and they have never found out what the kingdom was here to do and who constituted the kingdom and who its enemies are. And this is a part of this message. There is more, my friends, in the writings and the teachings of the apostles concerning what Jesus said about his enemies and about the processes of his kingdom than anything else. And this should be a very cardinal point in the message. So we find that the Sanhedrin, which was the courts of the land, was in the power of the same rascals that are controlling your courts all over the land, have been surrounding your presidents and influencing your high court, just as it was in the days of Jesus. Only thing is that they had more high court positions that they actually held. In the instance of the many miracles that Christ performed, it upset their dead tradition. When he healed the man by the sheep pool and told the people to go on down to the temple and not hang around this old sheep pool, it upset their tradition and they wanted to put him to death. Whenever Jesus said or did something that countermanded their false declaration, they would plan how they would put Jesus to death. One day, the Jews trapped Jesus, they thought, down in the treasury room, down underneath the temple. And they brought him down there, and they asked him questions, and when he made declaration concerning his identity and who he was, and the thing that they wanted to trap him with was some area of identification with his divine authority or from whence he came. And he told them that where he was going, they couldn't come, which was talking about his ascent back into the heavens. There's no Jews in heaven. Isn't that a wonderful thing? There's none there. Jesus said, where I go, you can't come. You don't have to worry about any relatives being bugged by these people. They've never followed them there. They can go down, but they don't go up. You say, how do you know? For Jesus proved this to them. He said, I am from above and you are from beneath. So you see where they come from, too. Now, in this instance, they trapped Jesus down. They thought in this treasury room, they said, we're going to put him to death. And these nice, kind Nazareth agents had taken stones down there, not for paperweights. They had planned on killing Christ in the treasury department. And so they took up stones to stone him, and they couldn't find him. They looked behind the doors, under the tables, and in the files, he was gone. Couldn't find him. They said to their soldiers, how did he get out? Didn't get by the door? Go see where he is. About that time, in came a soldier from the outside. He said, you looking for Jesus? I thought you had him down there. He's outside preaching to the people. They said, how'd he get out of this room? Another time, they gathered around him to stone him, and he passed out through their midst. They couldn't see him. You know, most of them lived down in the areas of Judea. Not very many of them lived in Galilee, except those that had control over some of the synagogues. The land of Galilee was apart from the rest of Judea in a very strict sense, because almost all the people that lived there were Benjaminites and true men of Judah. The word Jew was one of the biggest misnomers of time. People think that this represented all the people in Palestine. It did not. As a species or a people, it only represented the Canaanites and Amalekites who were called Jews. But their control over the religion through chicanery dominated now all the ecclesiastical orders of Palestine. Therefore, they called their religion Jewry. And thus men could be Israelites, they could be Benjaminites, they could be the stock that later was to be known as German, along with the Visigoths already there. They could be Normans, they could be Anglo-Saxon people, but if they lived in Palestine and they had to go to a synagogue under the control of these people, they were called Jewry. However, they were not designated thus by province. Thus it was that when Christ had identified Judas Iscariot in the 6th chapter of John, the last verse. He said, I've chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil. Now, this is a species. The devil is an offspring of Lucifer's or angels, and his own being that didn't keep first estate. They're a species. They're called devils. They're just not a name you call somebody. They're an identity to a species. Now, under this instance, it said, having identified this odd fool with the Jews, Jesus had to go down in Galilee. He couldn't walk among Jewry because the Jews sought to kill him. Thus, this body of God visiting men, this the fullness of God dwelling bodily among them, as the Apostle Paul told us in 2 Hebrews, since your children of God were in bodies of flesh, then he would have to take a part of the same. Wasn't ashamed to call your race his kinsmen. In this instance, then, his family lived in Galilee. But no man, we're told in the 7th chapter of John, dare speak openly of Jesus for fear of the Jews. But there wasn't enough Jews down there for him to fear them, or to fear them stepping up some program against him ahead of time. Though he had restraining influences, the fact remains that as he assumed a body of flesh, he had not given himself any special protection other than his ability to pass through their midst or his control of dimension. We point out in this work, which is here demonstrated, that in the land of Palestine, they continue it, were seeking to entrap Christ, and when Jesus went down to the feast, they were hunting for him everywhere in order to trap him, to put him to death. Now, I want to bring to your attention the fact that in these events, which we haven't time to review, the majority of the people or true Israelites wanted to crown him king. His influence was great, and his identity of the enemies of the kingdom of God and how they had gained power was also a very intense declaration. So, let us note about the high priest. I want you to know that the Sadducees, the high priests, were Jews. I want you to know that all the Jews today admit that the high priests in the time of Jesus were Jews. I want you to know that none of the modern Jews of today, of any modern synagogue today, for one moment question the fact that they ran the synagogue, that they ran the temple, and that they were the high priests, the Sadducees and the scribes, all right? And we're going to take their word for it. I read over here in the 26th chapter of Matthew that it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these things with his disciples, that you know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover. Now, Jesus said that the Son of Man will be betrayed and crucified. And there assembled together the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders in the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas. This is this Canaanite son-in-law of Annas, who was thrown out for bribery. Now, and they consulted how they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. So here's a murder plot of Jews, high priests and chief ecclesiastical leaders, against the body of God that did nothing but perform miracles and do good in their land. Now, this just lets you know a little bit about the nature of Jews, and don't go out of here thinking they've changed a bit. They haven't. Their high priests at that time planned by subtlety how they were going to take Jesus and kill him. They were murderers, as Jesus said they were, and they came from their father the devil, and his son was a murderer. Now, I want to turn from this 26th chapter of Matthew. I want to go over to Mark, the 14th chapter, and the first verse. And I want you to hear what it says here. Now the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him by craft and how they might put him to death. But they said, we don't dare do this on a feast day, lest there be an uproar from among all the people. So this should introduce something to you. The people accepted Christ. The people were behind Christ, and this minority of evil, even though it had by chicanery gained power and held it, were afraid to move against Jesus because of the people. Sometimes I want you to know that the most powerful thing you can do today is tell it, tell it, tell it, to so many Christian Americans believe and stand with you that the Jews become paralyzed or afraid to move. Now also I turn to the book of Luke, and it said that the high priest plotted with them how they might put him to death. So we have a group of conspirators, we have a group of plotters, we have a group of murderers and assassins. And they, my friends, are the Supreme Court in the land of Palestine. What a trial you get from this group. Now I turn to some interesting records. We have thought this week about the mighty passion of Christ. We've caught the very vibration of this miracle of God in the flesh, assuming in a legal act in that garden all the transgressions of the earth. And I always find myself somewhat amused that his very enemies were actually involved in trying to put him to death, and when they did this, they defeated their own kingdom. And he knew all about what they were doing all the time, and he let them proceed with this because it was going to do two things. It was going to defeat their kingdom and should have given a lesson to his people forever concerning the nature of this people. Now, I think it rather significant that we point out that when Jesus went into the garden to pray that night, they had already plotted how they were going to put him to death. But I happen to have here a copy of the Mishnah. And I want to call to your attention some very interesting things. I'm reading here now out of the Mishnah that a capital offense must be tried during the day from sunrise to sunset, and all prosecutions must be suspended at night. That a capital offense can only be tried by the lesser Sanhedrin unless it is a high priest or a whole city in blasphemy. The oral tradition, which is also codified, as I have a codification here of the Mishnah, holds to this hour, cites that the greater Sanhedrin and the lesser Sanhedrin cannot sit at night, nor can the council of this Sanhedrin for the indictment, like a grand jury, cannot sit at night, for they must suspend all operations at the setting of the sun. I think it important for you to remember this point, that the Sanhedrin can not only not sit at night, but it is forbidden for the Sanhedrin to sit upon a day which would be the eve of the Sabbath. Because the second day after an accusation, the defendant has a right to defend himself against any capital offenses and crimes and must make this presentation on the second day. Therefore, this could not be done if it was a holy day or a high religious holiday, such as the Passover, and this could not take place if it was in Passover week, or could it take place if it occurred on the eve of the Sabbath, which would be a Friday night. Therefore, any violation of this law was a violation of the ancient law of Israel, was a violation of the Mishnah, it was a violation also of the Repar. Therefore, all of the laws and the codifications of the laws of Palestine were thus involved in it. Now we point out that the one who betrayed Jesus, Judas Iscariot, was an agent of that court. An agent of that court cannot take money for having betrayed a man into their hands and then deliver him into their hands at night, because he, being an agent, must deliver him in the daytime, and he must be seized from sunrise to sunset. What I want to point out is the Jews have no respect for law, and even when they hold their authority on the guise of supporting the pattern of law, they violate every procedure when it relates to them, but they want to enforce every avenue of law and laws that do not exist when they deal with you. A double standard is a Jewish procedure. You'll discover this right here in the state of California. If a Christian church wants to lease a hall to hold a meeting to discuss the truth, and the Jews don't want it, they can deny you the hall, or they can deny you the rental of the building. But if a bunch of Negro, Mohammed X movement, or the NAACP want to rent the hall and you deny it the use of the hall, then you're in violation of the Rumford Act, and they then will sentence you, they'll fine you, they will give damages to the Negroes. But this is a Jew double standard. They don't want to do this for you. We'll find out one of these days. Let me point out to you that in this time, we see the magnitude of the evil of this mistrial of God. So in this instance, we find Jesus praying in the garden when a Jewish army of the high priests with swords and with spears, with an agent of the temple and a betrayer, move into the garden at night. Now, this man being always in their presence day and night, moving in their midst by day and by night, had to be seized in the daytime because he was not fleeing, nor was he leaving the country. So they seized him illegally at night. Number one, Judas Iscariot betrays Jesus. What a despicable character he was. And Jesus turned and said, "Betrayest thou the embodiment of God with a kiss?" What a slimy rascal that had thought all this time he was deceiving somebody, and Jesus knew about him all the time. Hadn't he said, "I've chosen you 12, and one of you is the devil"? But then this was his nature and the nature of his household, and thus it could be expected. Now we turn to where did this army take Jesus? So we discover that one of the first things that they did having seized Jesus, why they took him to the house of the one called Annas, who was the former high priest. I think this should show also the power of this hierarchy, that when they took Jesus to Annas, the band and the captain and the officers of the Jews, we're told here in the 18th chapter, the Gospel according to St. John, took Jesus and bound him, and they led him away to Annas first. Why did they take him to Annas? Because this old Jew highbinder who had been thrown out for bribery still ran the Jew hierarchy, and he was the head of the Jewish mafia. And he had already had four of his sons high priests, and Caiaphas was his son-in-law high priest. You see the power he had, even with his gold over Rome. So we read these words. They led him up to Annas the high priest. And then, now Caiaphas was the one among the Jews who had counseled the people that it was necessary they kill this man or their people would lose control of the nation. This is recorded right here in the next verse. So now we have an evidence here when he was taken to the house of his father-in-law that whereas Annas was not the high priest, he controlled the hierarchy, and his son who was Caiaphas, or son-in-law Caiaphas, had been one who had planned to put Christ to death. They made no question about the fact that they must eliminate Christ or lose control politically of this country, even though they had witnessed his miracles and had no spiritual capacity to understand any of the truth which he taught. We are told then that under this instance that having taken him before Annas the high priest, who sought to set up a special council for interrogation that night, they took him from Annas' house to the residence of the high priest Caiaphas. And it tells us that when they took him to Caiaphas, they then delivered him into Caiaphas, who was the high priest, and they took him to the house of Caiaphas, where he had a council chamber. Now the high priest asked Jesus of his disciples and his doctrine. Now let's go back to a little interlude of history that comes out of the records of the days of Nicodemus and of who he was. Nicodemus was a Pharisee, a true Pharisee and a true Israelite. He taught every day on the steps of the temple with his theological students. It had been this man who had beheld the miracles wrought by Christ and the sayings of Jesus, who saw him scourge the Jews off the steps of the temple where they made the temple a place of merchandise. It was this Nicodemus who loathed all that was evil that was done by the high priest and his group, but who also had a seat upon the Sanhedrin, for he was high in authority. But when he saw and heard Jesus, he went to him at night. And he said, Master, I perceive that thou art a man that's come from God. Now what I want to know about you, are you the one? And so it was that Jesus told Nicodemus the many things concerning him. He knew he was a righteous man, a just man, the master of Israel, but there were some things he didn't understand. But after Jesus had explained to Nicodemus who he was, Nicodemus accepted the fact that this was the line of David, this was the stock of Messiah, this was a holy man and a prophet, and maybe this was the Messiah. So he went back among his students, and he taught them every day on the steps of the temple, and he told these Israelite students of the households of the true houses of Israel, who all of them were Pharisees, he said, this man is a prophet, and he may even be Messiah, for he is one who teaches the truth. He is a rabbi, master or teacher, come from God. Today the word rabbi has fallen into disrepute among intelligent Christians because we today identify it with these Canaanite phonies who run the synagogues all over the land. But the ancient word rabboni or master didn't fall into this category. Thus it was that Nicodemus was a revered student of the scripture and a great professor and teacher of the true law. And he also had another friend, a powerful friend, and another great Pharisee that sat on the Sanhedrin. This man's name was Gamaliel. So it was that one of the students of this man, Nicodemus, was a man whose name was Barnabas. And John Barnabas was a theological student in the teachings of Nicodemus. And as he walked along the street, hurrying to his quarters upon this evening, he saw an army of men that were carrying swords and spears and lights, and they had a prisoner. And wondering why this was, as they were approaching the house of Annas the high priest, he also followed them. And to his dismay, he saw that they had Jesus bound and fettered, and they were taking him into the house of Annas. He hurriedly ran over to the home of Nicodemus, and he beat upon the door. And he said unto him, Nicodemus, O Rabbi Nicodemus, behold, Yahshua, the mighty master teacher, Rabboni, is being taken to the house of Annas tonight, bound and in chains. So the Rabbi Nicodemus said, this is illegal. He can't be arrested at night. Surely you must make a mistake. No, he said, I saw this. They arrested him. They were taking him at night. He said, I send you now to summon the Rabbi Gamaliel and send out word that the Pharisees must gather quickly. And so then Nicodemus proceeded his way to the house of Annas. By the time he arrived there, they'd already taken Jesus to the house of Caiaphas. Now the scriptures tell us about the record. And also I have in the patterns of the Mishnah the full pattern of the law, and I have here the Kever, which contains also its measures of law. And these are the whole pattern of the measures of this law. As Nicodemus came into the area where the Sanhedrin of 23 would sit in its council chamber, behold, it was packed with Sadducees. And there were a couple of empty seats there, but in the council, but in the rows where they selected the alternates, they had those packed. There was 53 men in there in this evening, and now this was illegal. And so as he entered in, it couldn't be the great Sanhedrin, they had to have 71. It couldn't be the lesser Sanhedrin, they only had 23. So this was a conglomerate council put together by Annas and Caiaphas, and they hadn't sent for the Pharisees. So Nicodemus walks in, and Caiaphas the high priest is seated at the behind the magistrate's seat. And he says, the Rabbi Nicodemus enters to take his seat in the great Sanhedrin. Nicodemus said, I can't take my seat in the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin cannot meet at night. Caiaphas is forced by the law to turn to the scribe and say, how readest thou? The scribe said, behold, the Sanhedrin cannot meet at night. Thou shalt take thy seat then in the great council. Nicodemus says, the great council cannot sit at night because we are not allowed to indict a man at night. It must be done between sunrise and between sunset. And they said, thou shalt take thy seat, or we shall eject thee out of here. We ask thee not to come, and thou must be still. Nicodemus said, I shall not be still against any violation of the law of Israel, the Mishnah, or the Shetter. So they said, the Rabbi Nicodemus takes his seat in the inquiry. We turn to the records of the book of John. Because we discover here that we have much concerning how he had been sent from the high priest to Caiaphas, and in the court of Caiaphas, in the hall of the judgment, and it was early, and they had no right to be in the judgment hall, but because they were thus defiling themselves from the Passover in the violation of this law. So as we read these words, we find their processes. One of the first things which they demanded of Jesus was to know what it was he taught. Jesus said, why do you ask this question? I have never hidden what I've talked about. I've spoken openly. I've been in the temple and in the synagogues, and you've heard what I've had to say. Why do you ask me now what I've taught? If you don't know what I've taught, then why have you brought me here? Then they said, you can't talk this way to a high priest. Well, Jesus had the legal right under the Mishnah to answer any question that was asked to him, or to forbear answering any question that he did not wish to answer at that time. So under this instance, the question was then asked concerning him, and I point out the magnitude of what was involved at this moment. They said unto him, now I ask you, what was it that you advocated daily? We read here that he said, I advocated the kingdom of God and the laws of our people. Now I turn to these people that had plotted to put Jesus to death. At every turn, they had tried by subtlety to put him to death, and I read these words. So they led Jesus away again before the high priest and assembled all the priests and scribes. And they sought to find false witnesses that they might put Jesus to death, and they couldn't find any false witnesses at first. Then eventually they did find some that for a price would bear false witness. We're told in the 56th verse of the 14th chapter of Mark. And they bear their witness, and thus we have the record from the Sanhedrin of the court that they brought in these witnesses, and one of them said, he said that he would tear down this temple in 3 days, and he'd build it again. Others said that he blasphemed and that he had called for sedition. And Nicodemus said, now, I demand that ye bring in the witnesses by one at a time, for now it is only the mouth of two things and the thing is established. So they brought in a second set of witnesses for each charge, and the two men, all the men disagreed in how it happened and where it took place. And so Nicodemus and now Gamaliel had taken his seat. They said to the rabbi, now I turn to these people that had plotted to put Jesus to death. At every turn, they had tried by subtlety to put him to death, and I read these words. So they led Jesus away again before the high priest and assembled all the priests and scribes, and they sought to find false witnesses that they might put Jesus to death, and they couldn't find any false witnesses at first. Then eventually they did find some that for a price would bear a false witness. We're told in the 56th verse of the 14th chapter of Mark. And they bear their witness, and thus we have the record from the Sanhedrin of the court that they brought in these witnesses, and one of them said, he said that he would tear down this temple in 3 days, and he'd build it again. Others said that he blasphemed and that he had called for sedition. And Nicodemus said, now, I demand that ye bring in the witnesses by one at a time, for now it is only the mouth of two things and the thing is established. So they brought in a second set of witnesses for each charge, and the two men, all the men disagreed in how it happened and where it took place. And so Nicodemus and now Gamaliel had taken his seat. They said, the rabbi Gamaliel enters the Sanhedrin. He says, the Sanhedrin can't sit at night. And they went through the whole thing again. And he said, I want to know in this inquiry, what witnesses are brought here, and how can man be indicted at night? They said, if you shall either sit in this inquiry or be ejected. And when they brought in the witnesses, and Gamaliel and Nicodemus were the only true Pharisees there, and they heard these charges, and that none of the witnesses agreed together, they said, these are false witnesses, and their testimony is of no value. How readest thou, says the chief priest. The scribe says we have to concur with the rabbi Gamaliel and the rabbi Nicodemus. So these fine upholders of the law tried to bribe false witnesses and frame Jesus like they frame Christians in the courts of our nation because of their Jewish evil hearts. Listen. I turn then to the demand which was thus made. Lo, as they spake unto him, they asked the false witnesses, having declared that he would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days. The high priest said, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses bet against thee, and what sayest thou? And Jesus held his peace. The high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God. Now here is the most deadly of all directions. This is the high priest adjuring and demanding an answer. And I adjure thee, he said, by the living God, that thou tell us whether thou be Yahshua or the Christ, the embodiment of God. The word always used for the embodiment of God was Son of God. The Old Testament prophets referring to him as the Son of Man, who would be with the mark above it of the tetragon, God in the flesh. Jesus said unto him, thou hast said, nevertheless, I say unto thee, hereafter ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the hand of power and coming in the clouds of glory. This was the proclamation that he was the Messiah. This was the evidence, as he said, thou hast said that I am a son of God. The high priest, when he had thus spoken, said, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need have we from witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard blasphemy. What think ye? And they cried, he's guilty of death. When Jesus had answered the high priest, they had smitten him across the mouth. Said, answers thou, the high priest thus? They had smitten him, and he said, why smitest thou me? Thou asked me a question, and I answered it. Now they called for his death, and Nicodemus got up and said, what is this?
You can't have a grand jury at night. No Supreme Counsel to indict a man. You can't arrest him at night. You can't try him at night. There's nothing legal about this. And now why do you say, what should we do with him? You can't sentence him to death. And they cried the more, put him to death. And they just outshouted the two Pharisees, Nicodemus and Gamaliel. You know, every once in a while I hear some patriot today say, they can't do this. It's against the law. It's not constitutional. And these rascals just go ahead and do it anyhow, don't they? They'll pay attention to the law. Only time they want to use the law is when they want to stop you. What think ye? They answered, he is guilty of death. Then they all came up, these Jews, and they spit on the face of God. Imagine this, the body of God right down here walking among men. Performed miracles, demonstrated his power, held the whole universe together, and even this crew before them had no bodies except he sustained the elements of matter that held them together. And then the patience of God to let this scurvy crew come up and spit on them. My friends, I got men in my staff who wouldn't take that, you know. I know what had happened if somebody came up and spit on them. But in this, we had a chance to just see how the patience of God for this hour were permitting them to defeat their own purpose. But they didn't know this. And so with this evil of the Jew, they spit upon him. And it tells us that having therefore buffeted him and smitten him and smote him with the palms of their hands, now prophesy unto us, Messiah, tell us who smote thee from behind. Then it tells us that the morning had come and the elders had counseled how they put him to death, but they said, we'd better not do it. If we take him out and stone him, the people are going to turn on us and they might have a revolt, and then this mysterious army might come back as well, Barabbas, and we might be liquidated. Let's make Rome do it. So it said, having counseled this, they took him down to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Probably there is no trial in history that takes on more significance than this, because as they took him down to Pontius Pilate, they awakened him, and of course this didn't make Pontius Pilate happy, for these chief priests and false Pharisees in this council had not only held several meetings in which they tried to put him to death, but it had come to the ears of Pilate, and the record is here also in the 11th chapter of John, that this Caiaphas had said, that if we don't kill this man, it's expedient to our control of this country that we kill this one Jesus. If we don't kill him, he's going to let his message reach the children of God that are scattered abroad. They're all going to accept him, and they're going to overthrow us, and we're going to lose our power. Now, when Jesus had first heard that they were plotting to put him to death back in the 11th chapter of John, it says, and therefore this council of Jews plotted together how they put Jesus to death. So in the 54th verse, it says that therefore Jesus didn't walk anymore openly among the Jews. In fact, he went to a far country in the wilderness, the cities of Ephraim, and he went on the ship to Joseph of Arimathea and went over to the British Isles. Now when he came back from this place, he had paid at the seat of the custom the coin. And you remember the controversy about whose coin this was, as he was paying at the seat of the custom on his re-entry into the land? Pontius Pilate, in his records, knew about Joseph of Arimathea being the uncle of Christ after the flesh, and knew that Jesus had been to Britain and back, which was a province in the Roman Empire. We find this in his records. He also knew that this man had performed great multitudes of miracles. Thus it is that when they brought Jesus before Pontius Pilate had been warned in a dream concerning this man. His wife had been, who had the dream, had said, behold, have nothing to do with the blood of this righteous man. When the Jews brought Pontius before Pontius Pilate, he said, what charges do you make? So I turned to the record of the Chedar's report. What charges do they make? They therefore said unto the Jews said unto Pilate, behold, we charge him with sedition, we charge him with blasphemy, and we demand that he be put to death. Pontius Pilate said, am I a judge in your court? If he is guilty of blasphemy, why didn't you put him to death? And they didn't want to answer Pilate, the record shows, but said, well, knowing that he was guilty of sedition, we did not want to rob Rome of its prisoner. Pontius Pilate said, "Ye've ever all been a seditious people. Never have you worried about robbing anybody of anything." So Pontius Pilate knew what he was talking about. Where then hath he committed sedition? Now all of this record isn't in the Gospels, but it is in the Roman record. In that he had charged that men should only give a part of their taxes to Caesar. How sayest thou this? For he said, "Render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar, and unto God the things which are God." Pilate said, "Is there error in this declaration?" They said, "We have no authority but Caesar." I want to point out something to you. You know, they were just as big a bunch of atheists as there are today. They admitted they didn't have any authority but Caesar, and they wanted to trap Christ on sedition because he said, "Render unto God the things that are God's, and unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's." This didn't bother them, except they thought this would make Pontius Pilate mad. Pontius Pilate said, "It is not the way of Rome to intervene with the worship of a people or the declaration of their God. Why hate thee this man so that did good so often in thy midst?" They said, "He is no friend. He hath blasphemed us, and he serves not Caesar. We demand that he be put to death. Crucify him." Oh, Pontius Pilate said, "Are there any witnesses that would stand in his defense?" We'll not go into this area of the trial, for over 100 people appeared and said, "Yes, he did nothing but good in our midst. He healed my child when it was sick. He opened my eyes. He healed my leprosy. He unstopped my ears. A woman who said, 'He restored unto me my son.' Truly, he's a great man and a prophet, and we believe that he's the Messiah come from God. And we testify before the old Pilate that he did all these things for us." And the Jews, which made up the great mass and mob, were crying, "Crucify!" And they had hired strangers. And they had hired brigands, thus a bunch of bandits and scum that had floated in and out with a caravan. Anything that was riffraff at their level, they hired to make up the mob, to make a bigger shout, "Kill him, kill him, kill him." Just like the kind of a mob you'll discover when the Jews stir up the NAACP and CORE and the Mohammed X movement and gather out the scurvy mass of communists and reds and beatniks they have when they picket a bunch of Christians. Pontius Pilate took Jesus into his own chambers, and he said, "I've heard much concerning thee. Now I want you to tell me, what shall I do with thee?" Jesus said, "Do that which is written. Why is it that they hate thee so? Because I have proclaimed the truth." Pontius Pilate said, "That's a strange statement. What is truth?" And then Jesus answered him a very mystic and secret answer as to what truth was. And Pontius Pilate stood out his hand. He said, "You're my brother." Because Pontius Pilate was a Basque, born in Spain, educated at the Druid University of London, and had married Caesar's daughter, and thus had become the governor of Jerusalem, the Roman province. But he was a master mason of the school of spiritual wisdom of ancient Israel. And the mystery of what is truth had been answered by Jesus. And when this school of masonry, which was in the aisles, had been the wisdom pillars to which he had been initiated because of his high lot. And now he perceived that Christ belonged to an order which had been dedicated to the preservation of the declaration of truth and was higher than he was. We are told here in the records which were possessed by the early church and also in Rome, that he had said, "I perceive also that thou art a master, and that thou holdest high chairs in the universe. What shall I do with thee?" Jesus said, "Thou shalt do as it is written." He said, "I am not a student of the things that might be written in the scriptures of this people. What am I to do with thee?" Jesus said, "It is stated that I shall be crucified." He said, "I'm not going to crucify you. You have not performed any evil that I have beheld. I have had thee observed, I have had reports brought to me, and thou goest about doing good. And now I see that you have traveled, and I perceive that you possess wisdom, and I know that you are better for this people than any of their priests, and I refuse to condemn thee." Parts of this narrative is found in the scriptures, other parts in the Roman record, other parts are found among the Essene Company's records of the trial of Jesus. The incident that follows
Pontius Pilate went outside. He looked at the faces of these Jews, this surly crowd. And they said, "What is thy decision?" He says, "I don't find any fault in this man." They said, "We want him killed." The judge says, "Not guilty." They says, "Kill him anyhow." Pontius Pilate walks back in and says, "These are terrible and turbulent people." And a messenger came to him and said, "You know, Herod is also arriving, and he's seated in his court at the house of his family on the hill. Why don't you send Jesus over to him? He's now a king of the Jews and a nephew of the Herod, of course, that had sought to kill Christ at his birth." And Herod had heard much concerning Jesus, and had been rumored unto him, we are told, that this was the man who his uncle had sought to kill. When Jesus came before Herod, he interrogated Herod, and Herod interrogated Jesus, and Jesus gave him no answers, except when he had asked him if this was true that he had proclaimed he was Messiah, and Jesus said, "As thou hast heard, and so sayest thou." So he had Jesus scourged, and he put robes upon him, and he sent him back to Pilate. Pilate said, "What am I to do with thee?" Jesus said, "You don't have to do as it's written." He said, "I don't want to do this. Now, therefore, you leave me no alternative, unless you plead. And now declare that not only are all their charges baseless, but plead with me for clemency. I am forced by Roman law to now scourge you and then bring you before the people and seek to release you again." So Jesus would not answer in his defense, and Pilate was forced to have him scourged. And he brought him forth, but now angry at the Jews and furious over the spot he was in, he covered Christ with a purple robe and said, "Behold thy king." They said, "He's not our king. We have no king but Caesar." But Pontius Pilate said, "He comes of the line of the kings of Judea. Behold the king." Now, what would you have me do? Release unto you Jesus the Christ, thy king, or Barabbas, who raided your caravans and Roman caravans and was ever a thorn in thy flesh? Who would you have? And these Jews, who loved their coin, their money, and their trade, still said, "Release unto us Barabbas and turn him loose to crucify Christ." I turn again in the book of John that you might see that this council is of truth. Pontius Pilate had made his declaration, and here we find it recorded in the 18th chapter of the Gospel according to John. He said, "I find no fault in him at all." Now the second attempt, when he said, "Hail the king," and they cried for his blood. Pontius Pilate said, "Behold, I have brought him forth that you may know. I find no fault in him." Now think of a trial that was passed from a false and phony fraudulent trial that had no right to seize him or involve him, brought him before now the civil courts of Rome and called for his death, but had to depend upon the decision of the judge for all policies of jurisprudence. And the judge had said, "Not guilty." The judge had sought to intervene. The judge had interviewed the prisoner, had heard the testimony, and the judge again said, "Not guilty, no fault in him." They said, "Kill him, kill him, kill him, or we're going to make trouble for you in Rome. You are no friend of Caesar." Pontius Pilate said to Jesus, "What shall I do?" Jesus said, "Do as it's written. I'm to be turned over to these malefactors." Then another legal act under Roman law, the covenant of the oath of clear water. They brought out the chalice bowl before Pontius Pilate filled with clear water. Pontius Pilate dipped his hands in this water, said, "I hereby, by this covenant of water, bear testimony before you that I wash my hands of the blood of this just and righteous man. And therefore I am powerless, for he makes no defense, hath ordained that I deliver him unto you. So I deliver him unto you, but I do it without guilt. For Jesus had declared, I lay my life down again and I take it up again, and no man can take it from me, and you don't have any power over me, Pilate, except I give it to you." But Pontius Pilate was not angry, he was strangely stirred. And so he said, "Here he is, look ye to it." "Oh no," the high priest said, "we're not going to crucify him."
This is Rome's job. Rome must crucify him. It's against our law to crucify him. This is a holy day. You know, I don't think anything Jews ever touch could be holy. How could they have a holy day? Why, I wonder why they bother this bloody bunch to even kosher their food, because kosher food, by proper design, would be properly administrated food. But this bunch of rascals, however, have nothing clean or good about them normally.
So Pontius Pilate wearily turned to the centurion and said, "Execute the judgment." And thus we go through these events that we meditated upon on Good Friday, of the travesty of the trial of God, of an evil household of Lucifer that Jesus said were of their father the devil, who plotted by subtlety and cunning to murder him, wanted to destroy him so the people wouldn't know it, finally in frustration seized him and illegally tried him, violated all the codes of law, all the courts of the Sanhedrin, and everything that related to it. In fact, when they condemned Christ to death, it had been Nicodemus and Gamaliel that walked out of the Sanhedrin and said, "We will never sit in the Sanhedrin again." They sent messengers out to gather the Pharisees, but it was too late, for Christ was crucified before they gathered. Did you know that outside of Gamaliel that the Pharisees refused to sit in the Sanhedrin after that? Did you know that the Sadducees and the pagans took possession, and from that time on have taken possession of the administration of the Sanhedrin? Did you know that Kahila, the insidious Sanhedrin of the learned elders of Zion of this day, are a bunch of Sadducees? Now I point this out to you, that in their evil and design, they chortled with glee when they saw the nails driven in his hands and feet, when they saw the final thudding of that cross into its socket and saw there the dying body of God. They had no capacity to perceive that this was God, but they were afraid of his power. Now they gloated over what they thought was his death. But the testimony of time was to change this. For even as he had hung his head and said it was finished, having called for divine mercy upon these Roman soldiers that knew not what they do, whose testimony later said, truly this was Jupiter. And we talked to you this afternoon about the intensity of that earthquake that rocked that hill, because on this Good Friday, the impact of all the universe was involved and all the earth, for the author and builder and creator was dying in his body, but his spirit was not touched. But as the body of God, with its molecular substances and affinity with the earth that he held together, was passing into the area of death, the whole earth rocked and tossed. And Matthew tells us, and the dead, within a few hours, were coming up out of the cracks in the earth and walking the streets of Jerusalem. And that, my friends, frightened these Jews until they ran and hid in the temple, and I would have liked to have seen that. They bore testimony of the mighty triumph of Christ, the conquest of the netherworld, the mighty power of his resurrection, of his bringing forth his many sons unto glory. But they trembled in fear. And then Judas Iscariot, when he heard Christ was resurrected, was as scared to stay on earth. He went out and hung himself to get back to the netherworld so he wouldn't be in the same place where Christ was. He was afraid. That's why it says that he hung himself to get back to his own place, back to the netherworld. Just like the demons that went into the swine went back, drowned themselves to get back to their own place. The Greek word Tartarus means the abode of the offspring of demons and devils. But Judas identified himself as Jesus had identified him. He was the embodiment of evil, a son of Lucifer. I want you to know that out of that trial, though they had condemned Christ, the judge said he was not guilty. Though they had condemned him with an illegal court, the two men who would have stood for legality said he wasn't guilty and denounced the whole court as proceedings, that upon the head of jewelry rests today the blood of Christ. And they said his blood be upon us and our children. One of their leaders out here in San Fernando Valley said if we had it to do all over again, we would make a more efficient job out of it. And Ben Heck, the scriptwriter, and the kike of Hollywood, who's given so much renown, and actually was a part of this brotherhood program of Christians and Jews, how ignorant can Christians be, said, leave it to the mob to bungle. If I had charged the crucifixion of Christ, I would have fed him to the lions, and then Christians couldn't have resurrected a savior out of hamburger. This is the mind of a Jew, my friends.
When we deport them out of this Christian nation, and when eventually the hosts of heaven take them from the earth and carry them off to their areas of chastisement and training, the world will know liberty again, and the sons of Satan will be gone. You know, the most startling thing that will face this modern Sanhedrin of the Kehila is going to be what Jesus said was going to be their great faith. When they see the sign of the Son of Man coming in the heavens, then when they see the host of the Most High coming in the clouds of glory. Eddie Cantor one day out in San Fernando Valley, when they asked about flying saucers and space objects, what he thought about them, he said, well, a great number of people think these are signs in the sky and their heavenly armies may have something to do with the second coming of Jesus Christ that these Christians believe in. And he laughed and he said, but I'll tell you this, if this is what it is, we've had it. And be sure that this is true. Someone said we should forgive all of this. My friends, if you shut your eyes and forgive God's enemies, they'll destroy your nation. And what they're worried about today are the sons and daughters of God that proclaim the truth. And they say, if we leave these people have free speech and these churches run, and this body of Christ in the world today, made up of you, the many members, carry out your ministry, we're going to lose this nation. But I'm going to tell you something about this. God Almighty is activating this mighty body that he has in the world today, made up of his many members. And anger and wrath will rise up in the countenance of this house of the Most High God, and there's not going to be a Canaanite left in the house of God. This is a great nation of God's kingdom. And we await for the spiritual energizing, for the guidance of divine purpose, for courts of true legality that will deport these people. And we will see the power of God move on the house of God to save America today and tomorrow the world. Oh, they hate the challenge of God's tomorrow. They hate the concepts of such ultimate victory. But I want you to know that the trial that condemned Jesus, condemned in the minds of all men the nature of his accusers, and that false trial proved they had no honor, no integrity. They by subtlety, by cunning, by graft, and by bribery, and by murder, they would have destroyed the body of God. But the body of God was done. The mighty power of his resurrection was to present it, spirit, soul, and body, a unit, one and complete. Come hither and touch it, this is flesh and bone. They walked with him, they ate meat with him, they watched him move into a cloud of glory and travel in a great super dreadnought out of the heavens back into the sky. They heard the words of two of the crew that stepped out of that cloud and said, this same Christ shall return in like manner. Now we remember his words when he refused that chalice, that crown, and took the chalice. He says, my kingdom is not of this era, my kingdom is hence. If my kingdom were of this era, my servants would fight, and the kingdom wouldn't be given to the Jews. He repeated this again to Pontius Pilate. I have four places where this statement was made in the ancient records in the time of Christ. We are now in that hour hence. We are at the climax of an age, and the kingdom is going to be salvaged, and the children of the kingdom are going to inherit the kingdom the Father has prepared for them from before the foundation of the world, and it shall not be held by the Jews. I'm going to tell you something about that ancient land of Palestine. That's going to be one of the greatest international parks in all time and history. That belongs to you and every other white Christian nation. And when God gets through with his judgments and with the great shakings of the earth and has buried a great much of these usurpers and has leveled out the land and has restored with his power and his glory, his majesty and his kingdom in the earth, we at that time, my friends, are going to see people from all over the world will travel to that spot just to behold that sight where Christ walked the earth and where these events took place. And in great nations like this nation of his kingdom, the glory of God shall go out forever. And so in this instance, we will discover that the court which they had sought to impose upon Jesus was the status of Lucifer in subtlety and evil. But his court will be that of the great judge, out of whom comes eternal justice, righteousness, and truth. We'll be speaking next Wednesday night in Lancaster in the question and Bible class, steady, those of you that come. Next Friday night, we'll be covering the blueprint of world events as they relate to biblical prophecy, and the earth is shaking again tonight. You can go back to your preview of 1964 and remember what we told you about the last week of March. We told you that there'd be upheavals and there'd be earthquakes and alignments and it would affect Alaska. We also point out that we showed you the ancient quatrains that said that if in the Azores and if in that area of the ocean that there were earthquakes and eruptions, that 40 days thereafter there would also be eruptions and there would be earthquakes and great tidal waves on the Pacific coast. 40 days ago, we said we only give you this quatrain because it does happen to fall at the same time that the prophecies come to pass by alignment to the end of March. So we point out to you that they may say you can't do it. They may say that it cannot be done and you're all wrong, but they can't deny that the earthquakes come on the right days. And they can't deny that they happen where prophecy and discernment declares they will happen. For I tell you that the Lord God does nothing except he showed unto his ministers and unto his household. And we shall move and walk through all these events and shall emerge triumphant as we see a world changed while we stand within it and a new age prepared for the eternal house of God. We're going to speak next Sunday afternoon. Does it make any difference who you are? Now, we've heard all kinds of stories about God being no respecter of persons. It doesn't make a difference who you are. Everything in the Bible is for you and for everybody. Next Sunday afternoon, does it make any difference who you are? Our subject next Sunday evening, prophetic and significant and tied in to some very vital information. When the nations of the earth remember. This is the subject next Sunday night, biblical, with a prophetic instruction. When the nations of the earth remember. This is our subject next Sunday evening. Let's see this auditorium packed next Sunday afternoon, next Sunday evening, next Friday night. Now as we take this Resurrection Day offering, the last offering of this Passion Week, we urge you in stewardship to render a sacrifice for truth, to endow as much as you can of the substance God's blessed you with to reach every one of your race you can reach with tape, to help us multiply and extend tape, to help us acquire more separate tapes besides those we send out for the increasing of the basic sets. Well, we must make more and more of these sets with greater demand upon them for those now moving and added to take place everywhere that want a basic set of instruction as well. Help us reach them. And as they in turn assume the obligation with tithes and offerings across all this tape circuit, help us to reach more and more with this expanding program. There's no end to what can be accomplished as we work fast to enlighten the nation, for you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Do not forget the broadcast and XDRB. Every day, 9:15, 10:90 on your dial. We urge you with your tithes and offerings to hold up our hands. How far we go in any area of communication depends upon your tithes, your offerings, and your devotion. And we seek all those out in the hearing of these tapes to generously support the spread of these tapes, and with your tithes and offerings make it possible to reach others. And so thus we take this offering for this Resurrection Day and urge you to give us the catalyst of your contribution to reach people with truth. Almighty and eternal Father, invoke thy blessing to rest upon this offering, multiply this offering for the declaration of thy kingdom, for the work of thy church, protecting and supplying the need of this people, and with the covenant of tithes, supplying them with thy blessing. And we ask it. Amen.